Hi, this is Evan Karish, Editor-in-Chief of Anesthesiology, with some highlights from the December 2020 issue, selected by the journal editors. I'll begin this month with a clinical study that examined the feasibility and the safety of cold stored platelets compared to platelets that are stored at room temperature, which is the current norm. Dr. Geir Strandnes of Haukeland University Hospital in Bergen, Norway, and colleagues there and elsewhere in Norway and the United States conducted the study. They performed a single center, two-stage pilot on adult patients who are undergoing elective or semi-urgent complex cardiovascular surgery. In stage one of the study, 50 patients were randomized to receive either platelets stored at room temperature or platelets stored up to 7 days in the cold. Stage two of the study was similar, except that the storage time for the cold-stored platelets was extended to 8 to 14 days. The primary outcome for both parts was clinical effect, as measured by chest drain output. In stage one, there was no significant difference between groups in chest drain output. The median chest drain output was 720 mils in the standard treatment group of room temperature platelets and 645 mils in patients who received cold stored platelets. The median difference between those two arms was 75 mils, which was not statistically significant. In the second stage, the 15 patients with extended cold stored platelets had a median chest drain output of 690 mils. Here, the median difference compared to room temperature platelets was 30 mils, which was also not statistically significant. Different. Clinical factors like total blood use, adverse events, and length of stay in the ICU were comparable among all the groups. The authors concluded that this pilot trial supports the feasibility of using platelets which have been cold stored for up to 14 days. Their results also provide guidance for future trials in high-risk cardiothoracic bleeding patients. Next, we have another clinical study, this one examining a hypotension prediction algorithm and its use in maintaining intraoperative blood pressure. Dr. Kamal Maheshwari of the Cleveland Clinic and colleagues there and at Fairview Hospital in Cleveland, Ohio, conducted the study. The hypotension prediction index algorithm uses the arterial waveform and features to predict hypotension. The authors tested the hypothesis that using guidance from the hypotension prediction index reduces the duration and severity of hypotension during non-cardiac surgery. The study defined hypotension as a mean arterial pressure less than 65 millimeters of mercury for at least 1 minute. They randomized adults having moderate or high-risk non-cardiac surgery to receive hemodynamic management either with or without guidance from the hypotension prediction index. Clinicians caring for patients assigned to the guidance group were alerted when the index exceeded 85 on a 0 to 100 scale, suggesting imminent or hypotension. A treatment algorithm then suggested giving vasopressor, fluids, or inotropes, or observation. Clinicians assigned to the control group did not have access to the prediction index. The primary outcome was the amount of hypotension, which was defined as the time-weighted average mean arterial pressure less than 65 millimeters of mercury. Among the 214 enrolled patients, about half were in the index-guided group and half were in the control group. The median time-weighted average of mean arterial pressure less than 65 millimeters of mercury was not at all different in the index-guided patients compared to the unguided patients. Index guidance also did not reduce the amount of hypotension below 60 or 55 millimeters of mercury. The authors concluded that the index guidance did not reduce the amount of intraoperative hypotension. But they also note that half of the alerts were not followed by any treatment. This could have been due to very short warning time, complex treatment algorithms, which took practitioners a while to work through, or clinicians simply ignoring the alerts. But the exact answer is not known. Our next clinical study attempted to correlate postoperative delirium with a preoperative assessment of patient frailty and cognitive impairment. Dr. Maria Susano of Brigham and Women's Hospital and colleagues there and elsewhere in Boston conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that even brief preoperative screening for frailty or cognitive impairment can identify patients who are at risk for postoperative delirium. The authors gave frailty and cognitive screening tests to 229 older adults before elective spine surgery. They used the 5-item Frail Scale and the MINICOG and Animal Verbal Fluency tests. They also gathered perioperative variables and postoperative outcomes, including the primary outcome of delirium. The authors found that frailty was a strong, independent predictor of postoperative delirium in a multivariable model. Naming fewer animals on the verbal fluency test was also associated with increased odds of postoperative delirium, as was more invasive surgery. The authors concluded that brief preoperative screening for frailty and cognitive impairment in older elective spine surgery patients successfully identified those at high risk for developing postoperative delirium. Next, we turn to a meta-analysis that examined several models of ketamine pharmacokinetics in different populations. Dr. Jasper Kamp of Leiden University Medical Center in the Netherlands and colleagues there and at the University of Colorado conducted the study. First, they did a meta-analysis of 18 published studies that used different methods of ketamine administration and blood sampling. Simulations showed that models based on venous sampling showed substantially higher context-sensitive half-times than those based on arterial sampling. Next, the authors constructed a new pharmacokinetic population model derived from a subset of raw data from 14 previously published studies. They then compared this new model to the meta-analytical analysis of the prior models. They found few differences in output of new and the meta-analytical approach. And the authors concluded that the meta-analytical approach gives a clinically applicable approximation of ketamine population parameter estimates. Moreover, this approach can be used when no raw data sets are available. Our next clinical study evaluated the effects of oral dexmedetomidine. As you know, dexmedetomidine is currently only commercially available for intravenous administration. Dr. Shubham Shamadia and colleagues at Mass General Hospital conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that oral dexmedetomidine would increase the duration of non-rapid eye movement stage 2 sleep during polysomnography. This was a single-site, placebo-controlled, randomized, crossover, double-blind phase 2 study. 15 healthy volunteers received 700 micrograms of oral dexmedetomidine or placebo. The primary outcome was polysomnography-established sleep quality. The subjects completed a motor sequence task and psychomotor vigilance tasks each evening and then again the next morning. The authors also completed sleep questionnaires from the volunteers. Polysomnography showed that the duration of non-rapid eye movement, stage 2 sleep, or non-REM sleep, was 63 minutes greater in the subjects who received oral dexmedetomidine, averaging 325 versus 256 minutes. REM sleep averaged 16 minutes in subjects who received dexmedetomidine and 23 minutes in the placebo group. Total sleep time was not different between the two groups, averaging 544 versus 523 minutes in subjects who received dexmedetomidine versus placebo. Overnight motor sequence task performance improved in the morning after placebo sleep, but not after oral dexmedetomidine-induced sleep. But there was no significant difference between those two groups. The authors concluded that the nighttime administration of oral dexmedetomidine was associated with increased non-REM to sleep and decreased REM sleep. Oral dexmedetomidine may possibly impair sleep-dependent motory memory consolidation, however. Our next study used a laboratory rat model to examine the role of upregulation of the acid-sensing ion channel, ACIC3, in postoperative nociception. Dr. Hao Li of West China Second University Hospital in Chengdu, China, and colleagues elsewhere in China conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that the upregulation of ACIC3 in injured tissues is induced by nerve growth factor through the phosphoinositide 3 kinase, protein kinase B signaling pathway. They tested their hypothesis using a rat plantar incision pain model and sham-incised rats as controls. They found that ACIC3 concentration was increased in incised skin and muscle. Both male and female animals showed less wound area sensitization when the ACIC3 channels were either pharmacologically blocked or when they were knocked down using small interfering RNA. There was bidirectional transport of ACIC3 between incised tissue and the dorsal root ganglia after sciatic nerve ligation. The authors concluded that anti-nerve growth factor treatment blocked the upregulation of acid-sensing ion channel 3 expression after incision and reduced the pain-related behaviors. Next, we have a clinical focus review article that discusses platelet function testing in patients on antiplatelet therapy before cardiac surgery. Dr. Elizabeth Mahler of Medical University of Graz, Austria, and colleagues there and at Sinai Hospital of Baltimore, Maryland, authored this review. Dual antiplatelet therapy is the first-line treatment of acute coronary syndromes. Although current guidelines only issue Class 2A or Class 2B recommendations for preoperative platelet function assays, there is growing evidence of an association between platelet inhibition and increased bleeding after coronary artery surgery. Preoperative platelet function testing may identify patients who are at risk for increased surgery-related postoperative bleeding. Testing may also guide the timing of elective surgery after discontinuing antiplatelet therapy. The authors note that testing may trigger targeted post-pump hemostatic therapy in conjunction with viscoelastic assays. Currently, there is no universal cutoff point of platelet function associated with bleeding that has been well defined in surgical patients. Even the optimal assay for such a cutoff point remains elusive. In addition to platelet inhibition, multiple confounders affect the severity of surgery-related bleeding. Thus, we need larger prospective studies using consensus-based bleeding endpoints in order to establish the utility of platelet function testing in these surgical patients. Such studies can also establish a potential therapeutic window for on-treatment platelet reactivity. Knowing an individualized preoperative waiting time and targeted intraoperative blood management could improve patient outcomes while shortening hospital stays and reducing costs. And finally, we'll close this month with a review article that considers the perioperative management of aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage. Dr. Deepak Sharma, at the University of Washington in Seattle, wrote this review. He notes that aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage is an acute neurologic emergency, and it requires immediate stabilization. Prompt, definitive treatment of the aneurysm is needed to prevent rebleeding. Treatment consists of craniotomy and clipping, or endovascular intervention with coils and/or stents. Extracranial manifestations of aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage include cardiac dysfunction and neurogenic pulmonary edema. Additional manifestations include fluid and electrolyte imbalances and hyperglycemia. Data do not exist on how anesthesia affects long-term neurologic outcomes of aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage. Perioperative management should therefore focus on optimizing systemic physiology and facilitating timely, definitive treatment. Selecting an anesthetic technique should be based on patient characteristics, the severity of hemorrhage, and the planned intervention. Anesthesiologists should be familiar with evoked potential monitoring and electroencephalographic burst suppression. Knowledge of temporary clipping, managing external ventricular drains, adenosine-induced cardiac standstill, and rapid ventricular pacing are also needed to effectively care for these patients. More noteworthy articles await readers in this issue of Anesthesiology. Thanks for listening. I'll be back in a few weeks with an inside look at our January issue. Meanwhile, I wish you all a very happy new year. And as always, I hope that this podcast and our journal help you deepen your knowledge and strengthen your clinical practice.